and I need my shut-eye. Things will look better in the morning. She stood and faced him.
How was her kiss?
I've had better.
Oh, really? From who?
He said, you've already forgotten?
I didn't forget, Archer. I plan on taking that memory with me for the long haul.
She kissed him on the cheek and left, shutting the bedroom door behind her. Archer went over to the window and looked out. Was it worth it? He didn't have a ready answer, which might have been an answer in itself. Archer did not sleep much. Every dream he had did not end well for him. Chapter 26. Archer heard a knock on his door at 6:30 a.m. Callahan called through the wood,
I'm heading to the studio for my early call, Archer. There are eggs and sausages in the fridge and bread in the box, and I've got plenty of coffee. I'll check with Donna about Ellie, and I'll leave a note with the guard if you want to drop by the set later.
I'm sure he'll be thrilled, he called back, so long as you're in your toga. An hour later, Archer rolled out of bed, showered, shaved, and dressed, and had two fried eggs, a sausage link, two pieces of buttered toast, and half a pot of coffee. And he was still feeling lethargic. It must have been the almost dying two nights in a row. He had sponged his clothes off the best he could, but at some point he would have to drive to Baytown and pick up clean stuff, and he could report in to Willie. He phoned Green and Ransom at 9 on the dot, and an efficient-sounding female voice answered. He asked for Cecily Ransom. She was not in, he was told. After he told her he had been hired by Ransom to locate Lamb, the woman told him to wait. When she came back on the line, she said,
Mrs. Green would like to talk to you.
You mean Bart Green's wife? Asked Archer.
Is there another?
The call was transferred, and another woman's voice came on. It was cultured, with a bit of flame attached at specific intervals, noted Archer.
I'm Mallory Green, Mr. Archer. Cecily spoke with me early this morning from her home and told me about her meeting with you and what you're investigating. She is very concerned. And I'm very interested in this matter as well. Very interested. Ellie has become a good friend of mine.
Okay.
I'd like to meet with you, and I think you should speak with my husband as well.
All right. Is he in town?
No, he's in Vegas, but I can have our pilot fly you there today in our plane if you wish.
Our pilot? Our plane? Thought Archer. It made one's little mind go round and round about what some people called normal. Let's talk, and then we can go from there. Where would you like to meet?
At my home. I was just in the office this morning to check on a few things. I'm leaving now.
Let me have the address. He wrote it down. It was in Beverly Hills off Santa Monica Boulevard. The address sounded expensive, and no doubt was. He gave her time to get there, and then got into his car and drove to her home. The rain was gone, and 1953 had its first day of sparkling California sunshine, at least through the dense smog, which was provided courtesy of all the smokestack and car exhaust huddled over them. He had taken off his head bandage, combing his hair straight over the wound, but redressed the one on his hand. At this rate, he might start looking like a mummy. The Green estate was gated, with a large G on the wrought iron, just so no one would be confused. High prison walls encircled the place. There was a phone at the gate to call the house. Archer duly called, and the gates duly creaked open. It was a typical Beverly Hills mansion, impressive in both large and small detail, with lots of terraced lawns, formal flower beds, and greenery sculpted by strong, experienced hands, and none of them belonging to the owners. He wasn't speculating about this. About a half-dozen muscled Mexicans were hauling dirt in wheelbarrows, spading the earth, putting large bushes in holes, and making this particular Beverly Hills palace all hunky-dory. There was a Greek Revival thing going on with the home's facade, and the round columns looked substantial enough to hold up the Treasury Department. The number and size of the windows was all L.A., though, and impressive, allowing the potent sun to filter through and ignite whatever the interior looked like to new levels of grandiosity for the visitor. It had the standard large central block, and two wings set at obtuse angles to the main. It looked like the imposing place was trying to reach out and hug him, an impression that was a bit off-putting. He pulled in front of the house, on a cobbled motor court, with grass growing perfectly between the pavers, and stopped next to a grain-white Bentley. He got out and felt the other car's engine. It was warm. Mrs. Green had arrived, in style. He wondered if she had driven herself. He doubted it, but maybe the lady would surprise him. He knocked on the door and then stood there, his hat twirling between his hands. He was led inside not by a butler, but by a young woman in a dark blue pencil skirt, long-sleeved white blouse and white pumps, with a thin strand of fake pearls around her slender, freckled neck. She had introduced herself as Sally Dennison, Mrs. Green's personal assistant. Well, that was progress over the aged, liveried statue at Alice Jacoby's place, thought Archer. Maybe the '50s really were ushering in a whole new dawn of bright personal minions in cheap heels and faux pearls. Mallory Green was waiting in a large room that could have been anything, really, thought Archer, so long as it looked expensive. She was in her late 50s, around 55, and thin in a way that perhaps spoke of skipped meals. Her gaunt, sibylline face reminded him of an axe blade, but the eyes promised greater subtlety than that. Her features, despite the gauntness, were both attractive and interesting in equal measure. Her lips were set firm and level, like a pair of 2x4s. The blue eyes were alert and seemed to flash whenever a bit of light from a lamp or the windows struck them, like exposed wires nestled together. The woman's hair was piled on top of her head, except for a few curlicue strands that trickled down over her small, lovely ears. Green had allowed her hair to go white, a confident woman, gracefully aging. She was encased in a dress of electric blue that served to emphasize the color of her eyes, not that they needed it. The dress flared out, providing the appearance of width to her narrow, boyish hips. The hem ended just above the bony knees, which were imprisoned in sheer stockings. The Cartier diamond-encrusted watch sat on a wrist looking like the world's fattest ring. For 9:30 in the morning, the lady was solidly put together and already in full battle gear. Archer took a breath and waited. Chapter 27. Mallory Green introduced herself and offered him coffee, which he accepted, because the effect of the half-pot already consumed had worn off. Eager Beaver Sally went off to relay the order. A maid in full servant regalia brought it back in a cup and saucer with a fine filigree design. Archer sipped his coffee without slurping, just to show that he too had a bit of culture at 9:30 in the morning, while wearing a still sandy, hastily sponged suit. "So you've had no word from Lem?" he said after the maid had departed.
"None. Neither has Cecily. We're all terribly worried."
"You might want to file a report with the county's Missing Persons Bureau."
"My God, aren't they already looking for her?"
"Not necessarily. She's an adult woman who can come and go as she pleases. I suggested to the cops that they consider her missing. But you filing a report can't hurt."
"Yes, of course, I will do so."
"So they haven't been by to talk to anyone about her?"
"Not that I'm aware of."
Archer didn't know what to make of that. "Does she have any family locally that needs to be notified?"
"No, but I believe she has family back east."
"So Lamb has worked at your husband's company for how long now?" The axe blade took a swipe at Archer and cleaved off a layer of his skin.
"It's our company, Mr. Archer. I'm a producer in my own right, though I create documentaries on subjects of importance. I've won 2 Academy Awards for my work, meaning Bart has 2 fewer than I do,"
she added, in a matter-of-fact manner. "Excuse me, I didn't know that."
"It's all right. No one ever assumes the wives in this town have anything to do other than dress nicely, stay skinny, not dribble what little food we do eat down our fronts, and never ever drink as much as our husbands, at least in public. To answer your question, Ellie has been with us for a number of years."
"I would imagine you can do what you want, Mrs. Green, being as accomplished as you are." He wanted to add, "like eat a proper meal every now and again."
"Documentaries, Academy Award-winning or not, do not make much money, Mr. Archer, but they cost quite a bit to make. Bart's simple fare, on the other hand, practically minced the stuff. Thus, certain compromises must be reached.
Archer was now done with discussing the Greens' business arrangement, otherwise known as a festering marriage. So you wanted to talk to me?
Yes.
What about?
A status update on your investigation, of course.
Those are usually reserved for the client. Right now, that's Cecily Ransom. She looked put out.
But Ellie is my employee, and I care about what happens to her.
I understand. So, while I'm here, do you know any reason why someone would want to harm Lamb?
No, none at all.
A man was found dead at her house. Someone had shot him in the head.
Yes, Cecily mentioned that. Do the police know who he is?
He's a PI from Anaheim named Cedric Bender. If Archer had pulled a rattlesnake out of his pocket and thrown it at the woman, it would not have had a greater effect on Mallory Green. Her eyelids fluttered, and then her pupils rolled like slot machine plates right into her head. He thought she was going to pass out, and she did slump to the side. She sat there breathing hard and looking distressed, holding her chest. "Are you okay?" he asked quickly. She nodded, but still looked weak and distraught. He rushed over to the bar, poured some brandy into a cut crystal glass, and brought it to her. "Drink this, you'll feel better." Green sipped the brandy and looked over at him, finally managing an embarrassed smile.
"You must think I'm mad or something."
"No, I just think you were shocked to hear a PI named Cedric Bender is dead. Would you like to tell me why?" She grimaced and put the glass down.
"I'm not sure what came over me. It's not like I know him. I have been feeling unwell lately. Maybe the flu. It's going around."
"It's not the flu." She glanced sharply at him.
"I tell you that it is. I've been feeling poorly all week, in fact."
"And you're sticking to that story?"
"It's the truth."
Archer put on his hat. "Okay, I'll be heading out now." She looked up at him, her blue eyes crackling with energy.
"What? Why? You just got here."
"I've been retained to find Eleanor Lamb, preferably alive. I don't have time to waste with people who are lying to me. Even I charge too much for that." She looked at the floor.
"How dare you accuse me of lying?"
Archer broke in. "It wasn't that hard in your case. Most people don't nearly faint and then lie so badly afterwards they have to stare at the floor because they're too embarrassed to look at the poor slob they're trying to blow smoke at. So either Bender is your maiden name and Cedric is your beloved brother or other close relative and you're understandably upset at his being murdered, or you hired P.I. Bender to do a job for you. In the course of doing that job, someone killed him. I told you he was dead. You clearly didn't know that, and it shocked you. If I'm off, just tell me so. But tell me so while looking directly at me, lady." Archer wasn't sure whether she was going to cry, attack him, or have him thrown out by the brawny Mexican grounds crew. She surprised him.
"You're obviously very good at your job, Mr. Archer."
"And I also have something called pride in my work, and a couple of morals resting in my pocket, one of which includes telling the truth. I know that's out of style in this town, but I keep trying. So why'd you hire Bender?" She looked up at him, those 2x4 lips now twisted in anger.
"To investigate my husband. I'm certain that crummy bastard is cheating on me. Again."
Chapter 28. Green had a second brandy, and Archer watched her drink it dry. When she was done, she put the glass down, cocked her 2x4 lips just so, and looked at him like she was itching for a fight with someone about something, and he was the only one within pummeling distance.
"I suppose you have many questions for me,"
she said icily. "If Bender was sniffing around your husband's infidelities, why was he in Las Flores Canyon? Do you think he was having an affair with Lamb?"
"Of course not. Bart only goes in for young and gorgeous. Ellie is neither."
"Well, then that leaves out her neighbor, Mrs. Danforth, since she's around 80. When Green didn't respond, Archer did for her. "So that brings us to the Frenchwoman, Bernadette Bonham. But she's around the same age as Lamb, and she's in France with her husband."
"Is she?"
"Well, I was told that, but I haven't verified it."
"Then maybe you should."
"I'm not working on your divorce case, Mrs. Green. That was Bender's job."
"I'm not seeking a divorce."
"What then?"
That's my business. As you said, it's not your job.
Archer shook out a cigarette and held it up. You mind?
No. The lighter's over there.
Archer picked up the lighter, as bulky and nearly as heavy as a cannonball, and lit his Lucky. He blew rings to the frescoed ceiling that held babies swirling amid clouds. When did you hire Bender? And why him?
I've used Mr. Bender before, when Bart was out carousing with other nubile women.
How'd you hear about him? He's way down in Anaheim.
Other women in Los Angeles that I know had used him when their husbands.
Yeah, I understand. Go on.
One of them recommended him highly, and I didn't want anyone from this lousy city. They all talked to each other. I did not want to be a laughingstock, any more than I already am.
She added testily. Okay, I get that. And I'm not laughing at you. I just want to understand the situation. She set her glass down and looked at him expectantly. Did you suspect your husband was seeing Bernadette Bonham?
The fact is, I don't know if it is her. Bender, I believe, was following up some other leads, too.
His car was seen outside of Eleanor Lamb's house.
Who by?
Eleanor Lamb. And me. It's now missing. But I guess Bender was watching the Bonham's place, not Lamb's. He provide you with any reports?
Why?
If he has, I'd like to read them.
Why?
She said more sharply. Because he was found dead in Lamb's house. The connection sort of speaks for itself.
Yes, he did. The reports. I have them in my study.
I can have copies made and get you the originals back. Green flipped a hand carelessly in his general direction.
Oh, all right.
She rose and left him, coming back a minute later with a yellow manila folder. She handed it to him. Was this the only communications you had with Bender? Did you speak to him? Over the phone, or here, or another place?
We had discussions on the phone.
Okay, so what did Bender tell you?
That Bart covers his tracks well. He has places arranged that he goes into and then out of from different doors. That Bart is always very careful never to be seen in public in the company of other women. This was all done with the purpose of allowing him to consort with other ladies who are not me.
You mentioned he had done this before? She rose and poured herself another drink. This time it was whiskey with no qualifiers. At this rate, she'd be snookered by lunch, thought Archer. She took a swallow and sat back down.
Twice before. Once with a starlet in one of his movies, who was young enough to be his daughter. She is no longer in acting. She went back to Wisconsin, or wherever the hell she came from.
So she couldn't act? Green gazed at him in stern amusement.
You don't have to be able to act, Mr. Archer, to become a star in Hollywood. But you do have to have a ruthless fire in the belly, because the competition is like nothing else on Earth. And you have to be willing to sell a significant portion of your soul, or perhaps all of it.
Archer momentarily thought of Callahan. And the second time?
A secretary at his office. Bart surprised me on that one.
How so?
He likes women with big chests, like the best racehorses. She was as flat as a pancake. But I guess she had other appealing attributes.
Archer couldn't help but glance at the woman's slender frame. She caught this look and smiled.
Bart and I have been married for over 30 years and have 4 children together. We met when Bart was different, and I was different.
There's always divorce.
Marriage, for some, is a competition, and divorce signals winners and losers. And in this day and age, the men are the winners, if they can get to that finish line. If I let Bart go now, he could publicly go out and get whoever he wanted. I, on the other hand, could not. And I would be blackballed in this town, because all the studio heads are lecherous men just like him. So if he wants to engage in adulterous liaisons, I just want him to have to work harder. That is really my only recourse.
Getting back to Bender, when was the last time you spoke to him?
The morning of New Year's Eve. We were going to meet for lunch tomorrow, and he was going to fill me in on things.
Did he give you a teaser over the phone?
No, He said he wanted to do it in person.
Well, that won't be happening now.
You can't possibly think that Ellie Lamb killed him. Why would she?
I don't know. Did Bender ever mention that he thought someone was onto him?
No, nothing like that.
She said quickly. Maybe a beat too quickly, to Archer's thinking.
I take it you don't want to fly to Las Vegas and interrogate my husband.
Not today, no. When is he coming back?
He spoke of tomorrow or the next day. He was rather vague.
You have a photo of your husband? She rose again, rifled through a drawer, and pulled out a framed photo. She undid the backing and handed him the picture. She answered his puzzled expression with a terse,
"Why would I want to look at him?"
Archer gazed down at the photo. Green was standing next to his wife. He was shorter than her, and far wider, with a blunt face, bald head, deep-set eyes, and a thin mustache over thick lips. The chin was weak, the cheeks inflamed, and still the overall look of the gent screamed a superior arrogance. "Looks like a peach," noted Archer.
"With cyanide inside."
He rose. "I'll get you Bender's original reports back as soon as I can."
"Don't rush. What the hell am I going to do with them?"
Archer took his leave, while Green poured another drink. He had met a number of remarkable and distinct women in a very short period of time. Archer had a fairly firm understanding of Gloria Mars, the warrior, and of Alice Jacoby, the dreamer always looking for the greener grass. The other three were less firm in his mind, but he was beginning to form a few impressions. Cecily Ransom seemed to be everyone's idea of the next generation's great filmmaker. A breath of fresh, honest air in a town full of fuggy smog and dreary, worn-out ideas. He had found her interesting and confident, but perhaps not fully grasping the dark world in which she wanted to spend her days as a writer and director. Mallory Green, the 2-time Oscar winner, was old school, but also hard and bitter about her unfair plight in life. He could appreciate it. He knew well the double standards employed between men and women in this town. Hell, in this world. But she also seemed ruthlessly transactional in her approach to life and marriage. She would make her husband suffer for his infidelity, but she would not sever that bond because her own career would take a clear, if unfair, hit. And then there was Eleanor Lamb. Missing person, afraid for her life, screenwriter extraordinaire, and a woman, at least according to Ransom's granduncle, Sam Malloy, who could not be trusted. "And I'm going to have to make my own decision on that at some point, if I ever find the lady." Chapter 29 Archer sat in the Delahaye out in front of the Green Mansion and read through the few pages of Bender's typewritten reports. The dead PI had not articulated a clear theory of the case yet, nor had he identified conclusively the woman Bart Green was allegedly consorting with, to use Mallory Green's term. But to Archer's thinking, it had to be Bernadette Bonham. Who else was there? But Bonham was supposed to be in France. Then Archer thought about something Sylvia Danforth had told him. He put the car in gear and headed back out to Malibu. The cops had gone from Las Flores Canyon. He parked across the street, squinting against the sun, and walked over to Lamb's house and into her backyard. He made his way up the same set of outside steps to the second floor deck and entered through the same door, which, obviously, the coppers had not bothered to secure, even if they had noticed it was unlocked. The body, he knew, was gone. However, the chalk line was still there. A poor facsimile for a departed life, he thought. But that was all you ever got from the homicide boys. The coroner would have already hacked up Bender. He wondered if the bullet in the man's brain had held together enough to be identified, and then matched against the gun that had done the deed, if they ever found it. And he wondered if the autopsy had shown anything else. And he could keep right on wondering, because Phil Oldham would probably blow out his brains before sharing any case notes with the likes of Archer. "Happy 1953 to you too, asshole!" He looked in Lamb's desk drawer and pulled out her checkbook. He sat down at the desk and examined the woman's handwriting and signature on the carbons. He took out a piece of paper from a drawer, grabbed a pen off the desktop, and slipped one carbon under the thin paper where he could make out the lines of her handwriting and signature through it. He traced these over and over until he felt comfortable enough to try it for real. He made out a check to the Willie Dash Detective Agency for $200 and signed it Eleanor Lamb in the lady's small, precise hand. He worked the check free and slipped it into his pocket. He left the way he'd come and walked over to the Bonhams. He jiggered the garage door the way he had before and walked in, securing the door behind him. Danforth had told him that the Bonhams had driven their car to the airport before heading to France. He slipped out his notebook and checked what she had specifically said. They left about a month ago. Archer knelt down and again looked at the oil slick on the garage floor. As Archer had thought before, that might be because Bender's blue Ford could have been driven in here to hide it. But really, what would have been the point in that? Would you take the chance that the cops might look in your garage and see a dead man's car? A lot of uncomfortable questions would follow. If that meant these marks could have come from the Bonhams' car, and as he had thought before, they sure as hell weren't a month old. He left and got back into the Delahaye. Archer looked over at Lamb's house as the rising sun started to wield its full heat and light on the canyon. Bender had met his end somewhere around here, unless he'd been transported by car. But Archer didn't see it that way. The man's car had been parked on the street. Sometime before 3 in the afternoon or so on New Year's Eve, somebody grabbed him, beat him up, and when they were done, they put a bullet in his brain just to be sure he wouldn't be telling anyone what had happened. Then at some point, they dumped the body at Lamb's place. The problem with that was, how could they be sure Lamb wouldn't be at home then? Had they been watching the place, or known for a fact she'd be out on New Year's Eve? But if she had been home, they would have had another person to silence, and thus another body to deal with. Why make trouble for yourself, unless Lamb were in on it? But what would be the angle? Was Bender simply investigating an adulterous husband and got caught in the crossfire of something far more serious? Wrong place, wrong time. Just like I was on that sand. Only I got lucky, and Bender didn't. As he was driving away, he saw Mrs. Danforth in her front yard, plucking presumably at some weeds. She had on a mauve house coat and a pair of white slippers. Her real hair, mottled gray, was down around her shoulders. From this distance, she didn't look a day over 75. Two cats were watching her every move like a pair of prison guards in the exercise yard. Archer didn't wait for her to spot him. He had other things to do today. The first being a trip to the Second National Bank of Malibu. Chapter 30. Archer didn't know what the First National Bank of Malibu looked like, but the Second resembled an In-N-Out Burger restaurant, including the red and white striped awnings on three sides. But the bank was far bigger than the In-N-Out Archer had visited in Baldwin Park, California, while he was there on a case. The food wasn't bad, and it was cheap, and Archer thought the place might make a go of it. He parked in front, and could see through the plate glass four women at desks working away like dutiful bees. There was a drive-through teller on the left side and two more tellers inside. There were three cars in the drive-through, four cars in the parking lot, and five people standing in line at the inside tellers waiting to do their banking business. Commerce was just flowing in this place like a high tide coming in. Behind a glass wall in one corner sat a big desk with a walrus of a man in a burgundy rayon suit that managed to somehow look faded. He was in his 40s and certainly well-fed. He was well-groomed, too, although Archer wasn't sure whether the man's hair was actually his or was simply on loan from the bank at a competitive interest rate. Next to the desk was a brass spittoon that did not look ornamental. Here it was 1953, and people were still spitting their tobacco instead of driving it into their lungs. Archer wasn't certain where they kept the safe, but every bank had one, which was why they kept getting robbed. Archer opened the door, causing a little bell to tinkle. The women all looked up and smiled uniformly, apparently in accordance with strict bank protocols, while the walrus glanced his way once and then returned to scrutinizing the pages of the Wall Street Journal, as though his personal fortune was all wrapped up in there. Archer approached one of the women and took out the check. "I had a question about something having to do with this." He showed it to the woman. She was in her late 20s, brown-haired, doe eyes the same color, and with a serious, attentive look, as though one day she wanted to be seated where the walrus was. The woman next to her was a cool, clear-eyed blonde gal with ambitions of her own, though her glimpse of cleavage where her sweater zipper had slipped down showed she was coming at the path to a better life from another angle than her co-worker. Doe Eye looked at it and said,
"What seems to be the problem? Were there insufficient funds to cover it?"
No, I actually haven't tried to cash it. You see, Miss Lamb already paid me. But then this check came in my mail and I wanted to return it to her. The woman looked at the address on the check and her confused look deepened.
Well, she just lives right up in Las Flores Canyon.
Yes, I know. I've been there. But she's not there, and the police won't let me in.
The police?
Yes, apparently they found a dead body in her house. Having obviously overheard this, the walrus put down his paper, rose from his desk, adjusted his cuffs, massaged the knot in his tie, and headed ponderously over. Can I help you? He said in a smooth voice that Archer took an instant dislike to. As a teenager, he'd bought a car from a guy who sounded just like that. And the car's transmission had failed as soon as the thicker oil the guy had poured into the gearbox to mask the failing gears clogged everything. When Archer had gone back to get his money, the gent disavowed all knowledge of the vehicle, Archer, or the existence of any known connection between them. I hope so, said Archer, smiling because he felt he had to at the moment. He explained things again. A body? Said the man, who had introduced himself as Horace Mincer, the bank branch manager. I've seen nothing in the papers. It just happened recently, and they're probably putting the kibosh on the reporters doing their snooping. Do you know Miss Lamb? Well, yes. I mean, as a customer of the bank, I do. He looked at the check. What did Miss Lamb need with a detective agency anyway? I'm afraid that's confidential. Mincer shot him a glance. Well, what do you want us to do about it, fella? I was wondering if you had another address for her where I could drop it off or mail it. She has an office somewhere in L.A., I believe. She's a secretary or something for a big film schmuck. I tried there. They haven't heard from her, and they're getting quite worried. And she's not a secretary. She's a very talented writer for the movies. The man looked at Archer like he was trying to feed him a line that could not possibly be true. Is that right?
Goodness,
said Doe-Eye.
She's gone missing?
Mincer glanced sharply at her, as though trying to determine from which planet the woman might have fallen into his bank. Right this way, Mr. Archer. Right, better to discuss this in private. It always is. The man gave him another stupid look that made Archer wonder if he could even add numbers, much less provide cogent information. They settled behind the glass wall, and the man took out a cigar from his desk drawer, sheared off the end with a pinky knife, lit up and puffed on it, his cheeks performing like fireplace bellows to get the ignited end going. Archer watched him do this and looked him over once more. In the fellow's 40-plus years of living, Archer came away with the conclusion that the gent had possibly stopped maturing around the age of 12. Mincer put his wingtips up on the desk, blew out smoke, and then tacked on a stupid grin. Now that we're away from the little girls, give me the straight dope on this, buddy. Come again. He held up the check and then dropped it on his desk. Who in their right mind turns down free money? You said the lady paid you twice? Okay, you keep both payments, and she can ask for the overpayment back. What kind of nut volunteers to do it? Archer pretended to be offended as he picked up the check and put it away in his pocket. This kind of nut. Plus I get the rep of cheating my clients. How long do you think I'd be in business? Okay, don't get all sore. It's no skin off me. What can you tell me about Lamb? Why? Mincer asked. She's missing, as I said. I'd like to find her. What do you want to know? Is she a good customer? Asked Archer. No problems that I know of. She bought a nice house up in the canyon, then did a big remodel, put in a pool and everything. You people owed the mortgage on all that? Mincer put his feet on the floor and swiveled to face Archer with the expression of a man about to do some business of his own. Technically, we're not supposed to talk about this stuff with third parties. He hiked his eyebrows in a crude show of silent communication. Well, speaking for interested third parties, how much does it take to get around technicalities in this place? Asked Archer, reaching into his jacket pocket for his wallet. Mincer glanced at the quartet of ladies, several of whom kept shooting darting glances their way. Not here. Let's go for a walk. I'm all for fresh air. Chapter 31. They crossed the road and walked along the beach where the sand was hard packed. The sun was high overhead, making it warm for January, and the tide was hovering in roughly neutral right now. However, even the distant breakers would cover any conversation they would have, Archer knew, which was probably why Mincer had headed over here, which meant the man wasn't all stupid. "The mortgage?" asked Archer. "There isn't one." Archer's jaw went slack. "I know she makes good money with her job, but that house must have cost 10 times what she pulls in during the course of a year."
"Maybe more than that with all the improvements she made."
"You sound like you know more about it than you let on back there."
"Let me see your cash."
"Okay, but keep in mind, pal, I'm a gumshoe, not a Rockefeller."
"Would you go a grand?"
Archer's jaw went even slacker.
"Oh, sure. If Lamb walks safely out of the ocean over there the second the green hits your palm."
"How about a C-note, then? I'm taking a big risk here, buddy."
"There's risk in getting out of bed every day. I tell you what, let me hear it first. Then I'll judge if it's worth the C or not."
Mincer stopped walking and puffed feverishly on his cigar.
"Do I look like a monkey's uncle, pal? I'm a branch manager, for crying out loud."
He held up a foot.
"I'm wearing goddamn floor shimes."
"Okay, let's say 50. I pay you half on your promise of having the goods, and the other half when you're done. That work for you?"
"I guess."
"This is not what I wanted to hear."
Okay, yeah, it works."
Archer passed him the money. They started walking again.
"Lamb moved out here, about 2 years ago. That's when she opened her account with us. She said she was buying the old Henderson place. We did have a mortgage on that. So I asked her if she wanted us to loan her the necessary funds to buy the property and fix it up, because she told me what she wanted to do with it. We had the survey and title on file and all. We just have to update it. All she needed was a male cosigner."
"Come again?"
said Archer sharply.
"An unmarried woman can't get a mortgage without a suitable man signing with her," said Mincer. "Didn't you know that, pal?"
"No, I didn't. Why won't banks make loans to single women?"
"Don't be stupid. Banks need a guy on board to feel secure. And it's for the ladies' protection, too. Dames are clueless about money and such. They won't get taken for a ride with a sharp guy around. Turns out it didn't matter with Lamb. She told me she was paying cash for the property and the renovations she planned, so she didn't need a mortgage. And I guess there's no law against a dame buying a house with her own cash, though there probably should be. Like I said, women have no head when it comes to money and business. My dumb wife doesn't know the difference between a passbook account and Passover."
"How much cash are we actually talking about here?" Mincer gave him a meaningful look.
"A total of 72,500 clams."
Archer whistled, because how could a man not when hearing that sum?
"And how do you know that exactly?"
"I know the realtor who did the sale. He sold me my house. And the contractor who did all the work is my brother-in-law. They told me."
"It's nice to be talking to a guy so in the know. And she had that all in cash. Did she say where it came from?"
"No, and I had no legitimate right to ask, but I was damn curious."
"Is there any way you can tell me what her balance is at your bank?"
Archer had seen from the woman's check register that her checking account had about $1,500 in it.
"She has savings and checking accounts. Without getting specific, I can tell you that it was nothing close to what she put into that house."
"So maybe she keeps it under her mattress?"
Mincer took a puff of his cigar.
"Hell, I figured maybe she was an heiress or something, or had a rich guy on the side. But she didn't seem the type. I mean, she was no looker, for Christ's sake. For a guy to pony up that kind of dough, you'd have to look like that Swede, Anita Ekberg. I mean, sweet Jesus, you seen the rack on that gal?"
"Not today, I haven't. Did Lamb ever mention moving out here because she had a friend who already lived here?"
Mincer tapped ash into the sand, while Archer studied the ocean as it began to creep closer to them, like a predator in the high grass.
"I remember during our first meeting, I asked her how come she was moving to Malibu. I mean, sure, a lot of people are buying out this way, but they're either famous or rich or both. Anyway, she said someone had recommended the place to her, and then she'd found out that someone she knew from way back had a place out here. She wanted to rekindle the relationship."
"Did she mention a name?"
Mincer dropped the cigar onto the beach, using his shoe to cover it with sand.
"No."
"Man? Woman?"
"Don't know. I mean, I could have asked, but I didn't really care. She was just opening an account. And I wouldn't be selling her a mortgage, so there goes that commission. And it wasn't like I was going to date her or anything."
"And you are married,"
said Archer, eyeing his wedding band. Mincer grinned and gave Archer a wink.
"When did that ever stop a guy in heat? and my missus is actually old enough to be my wife. So, a body up there, you said. Know who it is?
Not yet, Archer lied. It's a guy.
And you said Lamb is missing?
Archer nodded. Whether by her choice or not, I don't know.
Damn. So anyway, where's the rest of my money?
Archer reluctantly placed the bills in the man's palm along with his card. Anything else occurs to you, ring that number and you can leave a message.
Okay, but just so you know, Mac, it'll cost you more.
Archer tipped his hat before turning away.
Boy, I didn't see that coming.
Chapter 32. Archer next drove to LA International, which was west of Inglewood and expanding at a rapid clip. What had once been a bean field was now one of the busiest airports in the country, operating 24 hours a day, with planes regularly rising aloft from a flat basin and into the embrace of the prevailing trade winds. As he was parking, he watched a four-prop Continental plane land on the runway and came to a stop a bit farther down the tarmac. He wondered if the Greens flew their plane out of here, or maybe out of Lockheed Air Terminal. Or maybe they had their own strip behind their mansion in Beverly Hills. The rich, apparently, did everything differently. After questioning a couple of people, he found the man he wanted to talk to, who oversaw parking at the airport. He was of medium height and wearing a gutter-dented gray Stetson fedora covering curly silver hair. His vein-flecked nose and overly ruddy cheeks spoke of the man's fondness for the bottle. He stood at the doorway of a little building that was hardly big enough for him to stand inside. He looked Archer over as he asked his question.
The Bonhams, you say?
Yeah, they live in Malibu. They flew to France about a month ago and left their car here.
So what do you want to know, then?
Is it still here?
What's it to you?
Archer produced his PI license and a fin. The man ignored the license and focused on the $5 bill, which Archer knew was good for at least 2 quarts of his favorite.
I'm a curious guy.
You say they've been gone a month?
That's right, replied Archer.
Well, they didn't drive here then.
Why not?
Because the airport don't let folks leave their cars here that long. They don't have the space, and they don't want the trouble if something happens to somebody's car. You got thieves in this town, you know.
Yeah, I heard that. But I was told they drove here.
They might very well have, only I'm saying they didn't leave their car here that long.
He suddenly grinned, showing all of his teeth, both real and false.
But there are lots of places around here you can leave your car for that long. Feel free to check them out and ask your questions.
Come on, was that really worth $5? Asked Archer, frowning. The man made a show of folding the bill and putting it in his pocket.
It was to me.
Where can I find out if the Bonhams actually went to France?
Information desk in the terminal. They can help you.
Thanks. And if I come back with more questions, does the $5 still hold?
We'll have to see, won't we?
Archer grinned and looked around at the shower stall digs the man called home.
I can see why you got the big title in the snazzy office.
One's born every minute, sonny.
Yeah, they are. Pardon me while I go suck my thumb.
Archer found out that the Bonhams had indeed flown from L.A. to Idlewild Airport in New York with stops in between. And from there, they'd flown on an Air France Super Constellation to Paris, via Canada and Ireland. The transatlantic portion of the trip had taken a total of 18 hours. They'd arrived in Paris on December 2nd. And then Archer got the whiz-bang follow-up that almost made him bite his tongue.
And then returned here on December 30th,
said the pert, efficient woman behind the counter.
Returned? Said Archer. Peter and Bernadette Bonham came back on the 30th?
The woman looked at her records.
No, according to this, Peter Bonham came back alone on a Pan American Airways flight from Paris to New York, and then he took a United flight here.
She looked farther down the page.
Oh, that's a coincidence.
What is? Asked Archer, who was still trying to process what she'd already told him.
You're here asking questions, and Mrs. Bonham is flying in today. Her plane from New York lands in about an hour.
Archer asked for and received the flight number. He tipped his hat and slipped the woman a Lincoln, which she'd deserved far more than the parking lot man had. After that, he headed to the airport bar to have a drink and wait for the Stratocruiser airline to touch down in the land of glitter and dung. Chapter 33. While he was having his bourbon neat, Archer called Universal Studios from a payphone and left a message for Callahan, leaving the payphone number for her to call back on. She did so about 10 minutes later, during a break in shooting, she told him.
Well, it's swell to hear that you're alive, Archer.
Keep your toga on. I plan to be around and kicking at least until tomorrow. Look, did you get a chance to talk to that gal, Donna?
Yeah, I did. Lam never showed at the Mars's party.
Okay, I figured that. But it's good to know for sure.
Where are you?
Waiting for a lady to arrive by plane after a trip to Gay Paris.
Well, aren't you the swanky one?
Her words were joking, but her tone was not. It's all work. How about dinner tonight? I'm buying, so pick someplace cheap.
Do you treat all the ladies this good, Archer?
None of them get it as nice as you, babe.
We knock off at 8. You can pick me up then. I'll book the best burger joint on Skid Row.
He hung up the phone, finished his drink, and checked his watch. A moment later, an announcement came over the loudspeaker that the flight from New York would be landing shortly. 2 minutes later, he watched the Boeing double-decker Stratocruiser descend into view out of the thickening clouds, touch down smoothly on the runway, and veer toward the terminal. The ground crew brought out the mobile stairs, and a minute later, the passengers began deplaning. And that was when Archer realized he had no idea what Bernadette Bonham even looked like. Danforth had described her as 40 and lovely and French. Oh, there were about a dozen of those getting off the plane that he could see, so that was no good. Archer watched them head toward the terminal building and then come inside. He followed the group to the baggage counter, where about 20 minutes later, a skycap appeared with a mountain of luggage, and people started to call out and point to their pieces. They each paid him a tip for the privilege of getting their own property back. As the passengers started to trickle out, Archer darted over to a courtesy phone and asked the woman who answered to page someone. A few seconds later, over the PA came,
Mrs. Bernadette Bonham, please call the courtesy desk. Mrs. Bernadette Bonham, please call the courtesy desk for a message. Thank you.
Archer watched as one woman, a slim, medium-height brunette, wrapped in a blue mink stole over a black skirt and jacket, with a light green blouse and an army green veiled hat, gazed around, surprised, and then hurried over to a courtesy phone, her suitcase in hand. Archer came up behind her. Mrs. Bonham? She turned quickly around and looked him up and down while he did the same to her. Her features were pretty much flawless, Archer noted. Sharp, straight nose, large, luminous green eyes, firm chin, square jaw, stellar cheekbones, and a look of intensity that was actually a bit intimidating. But maybe that was just the French in her.
Yes, and who are you?
A discernible accent underlay these few words. Archer held out his PI license and explained who he was and what he'd been engaged to do. Her very fine cheekbones sagged under the weight of all this.
Eleanor Lam is missing, and the dead man was found in our house. You mean right next door to us?
That's right. Can we go somewhere and talk for a few minutes?
I really need to get home,
she said, glancing around. Is someone picking you up from here?
No, I will take a taxi.
Long taxi ride to Malibu. Is your husband waiting for you there? She looked at him with what Archer thought was a fearful expression.
What? Peter?
Yes, I understand he flew back here on December 30th.
No, I mean, yes, that is correct. It was then that he came back. And then I followed.
I just have a few questions. Maybe we can sit in the lounge and have a cup of coffee? I know it was a long flight from the East Coast.
Yes, it is very tiring.
I hope you stayed over in New York for a bit after flying back from France. Her green eyes fluttered so erratically, Archer thought she might be on some drug.
One night, yes, at the Waldorf.
Nice. He carried her leather suitcase with gold-trimmed straps, and she allowed him to lead her to the lounge, where he ordered 2 black coffees. She placed her stole on a chair and took out a pack of cigarettes that made Archer smile. She noted this and said,
Yes, you know this?
Unfiltered Gaulois Bleu. I had some French buddies smoke them during the war. Tried one. Strongest tobacco I ever put in my mouth. She seemed pleased by this acknowledgement.
Yes, it is very strong. That is how we French like it. Just like our café. Would you like one?
He drew out his luckies and shook his head. These helped me get through the war. and I recently tried drinking a Chinese liquor that nearly killed me, so I think I'll stick to what I know. I might live longer. He lighted her smoke, and did the same for his own. Their coffees came, and were hot and bitter and strong.
So you met Eleanor when she moved out to Malibu?
Surprisingly, Bonham shook her head.
No. Our families knew each other when we were much younger. Her father, Charles Lam, was in the diplomatic corps for this country. My father, Mathieu, was the same for France. He was attached to the French embassy in Washington. Eleanor and I went to school together there. Then she went away to university, as did I, only in Paris. But we both came back to Washington afterward, and lived with our families for some time. Then my family moved back to France, and I went with them.
Archer thought about what the banker had told him about Lam moving out to Malibu to be close to someone from her past, and Danny Mars had said pretty much the same thing. Well, Bernadette Bonham had just moved to the top of the list for that trophy. And then all those years later, she moved to Malibu, where you and your husband were living. I guess you were excited to see your old friend. Bonham puffed on her Gaulois and didn't answer. She looked out the window at a DC-6 taxiing for takeoff.
France has not changed much after the war. We go now for the last 3 years. There is still so much that is destroyed, gone, never to return. It is very sad. So much beauty. Poof. I did not like it. It is not the same.
This statement didn't sit too well with the Army veteran Archer. Well, at least you're not speaking German. There is that. She settled her luminous eyes on him in a disarming manner.
This is true, what you say.
She took off her hat and set it on the table. Bonham tapped her ash into the ashtray and said in a contemplative tone, as though she were testing its veracity.
Eleanor and I were not what you would call very good friends. Though our fathers got along splendidly, we were very different.
Having met her and now you, I can see that. But sometimes different is good. She glanced up at him.
And sometimes it is not. She was always very intense. There was no, relaxing time with her.
So her moving next to you wasn't a good thing then? Bonham shrugged and said in a casual tone,
I did not care one way or another.
She pointed her Gaulois at him like a miniature sword.
But I can tell you this. My husband did not like her.
Why not? She threw up a hand.
I do not know. They just did not hit it off, as you Americans say.
You have an example you can share with me? Her brows furrowed. Archer could see her translating his request in her head and deciding on an appropriate reply.
We had a party at our house. This was about a year ago, you see? We invited people from Malibu, L.A., you know. A nice, interesting group.
And did you invite Lam?
Of course. I mean, she lived right next door to us, and I knew her from before, as I said. It would have been rude not to. We even invited the old woman, though she did not come.
Mrs. Danforth?
Yes, but Eleanor did come. I welcomed her. We spoke of old times in Washington. She seemed, far more casual than usual. She actually seemed to be having a good time. But later I saw her and Peter having what you would call words.
Did you hear any of what they were saying?
No, only that Peter was very angry, and Eleanor was very cool and calm, just like her father was. He was a very good diplomat, my papa used to say. When they saw me watching, they smiled and went their separate ways.
Did you ask him later what had happened?
Yes. He said it was a difference of opinion over some property line disagreement.
Did you believe him? She stubbed out her cigarette.
Do I look like an imbecile, Mr. Archer?
Quite the contrary. But do you think there was any hanky-panky between them?
Are you an imbecile?
She exclaimed.
You have seen me, and I presume you have seen Eleanor. As a man, do you think there is a difficulty in choosing between us?
I guess not.
Précisément,
she said, giving him an incredulous look. What happened at the party after that? Asked Archer.
Elinor left shortly afterward. She even thanked me for a lovely time. She always managed to land on her feet. And I think that she got the better of Peter in whatever they were discussing.
She added,
I understand that she is a very good writer of films.
Who'd you hear that from? Bart Green? Asked Archer.
Why do you mention him?
Because Lem works for his production company. Archer left unspoken, and Bart's wife thinks you're bed-hopping with her hubby.
Yes, I think I knew that.
So you know the Greens?
Yes, Peter introduced me to them some time ago. Bart Green is very successful in making movies, yes?
Yes. How did your husband and Bart Green meet?
In some business dealings. My husband has many interests.
Where'd you meet your husband? She looked more animated now.
As I said, my family had moved back to France before the war began. Then afterward, we were forced to flee to Canada. We knew it was only a matter of time before the disgusting Nazis conquered our homeland. My papa was very outspoken about Hitler. We had to flee, or we would have been killed. But after the war was over, we moved back to France and were living in Paris. Shortly afterward, I met Peter there and we were married in Nice. Then we came here. Peter had the house in Malibu already, you see. He bought it when he was no longer married. He was a...
bachelor?
Précisément.
Wait a minute. So he was married before? This didn't jibe with what Danforth had told him.
Yes, but he does not speak of that time in his life. His first wife died. I know nothing more, and I do not care to know more.
He's from California, then?
I'm not sure, but he has business here.
You mentioned that. What sort of business? With Bart Green?
Oh, a great many things. But you see, he is much older than me. He is over 50 now, but still very handsome. And he is very cultured, and knows how to treat a French woman just so, and it is not an easy thing to do, n'est-ce pas?
Yeah, I tried and failed at that a few times during the war. Her big green eyes managed to widen even more. She looked intrigued, and even graced him with an amused smile.
Yes? You did this?
Oh, yes. Very poorly, and the ladies let me know it. So a great many businesses. Like what?
This and that. I have no head for it, and no interest. It provides a wonderful living for us. That is what interests me,
she said candidly. He looked over her expensive clothes. I'm sure.
So, thank you for the coffee, but I have to...
He cut in, deciding to go on the offensive now. Look, I can drive you out to your house, and then I could talk to your husband. He might have some idea where Lem is. She looked alarmed by this proposal.
I do not think that is likely. As I said, he did not care for her.
But still, he might have seen something. I mean, he would have been right there when it all happened with the dead man and Lem going missing. He looked across at her as she sat there in her fine clothes, with her intriguing French accent, and he wondered if she had been enjoying trying to play him for a sucker before he landed this counterpunch. She seemed to think quickly, perhaps a bit too quickly.
I don't believe he was there that night.
She had made it all too easy to land the knockout blow. I don't believe I mentioned the night it happened. She took a few moments to light up a fresh Gaulois and give herself time to think of a response, Archer knew.
I actually will not be going straight home, so I will have no need of your assistance, but thank you.
Just trying to be friendly.
Yes, you are too kind, Mr. Archer,
she said curtly. Just so you know, the county cops will probably be by to talk to you and your husband now that you're home. She looked alarmed once more.
But why would they do that?
A murder happened right next door. They've already talked to Danforth. They tried your place, but you weren't home. I guess your husband stayed somewhere else on New Year's Eve, because he didn't answer their knock the next day.
Yes, he must have,
she said quickly. Do you know where that might be?
No, I suppose the hotel.
But you have such a swell place in Malibu.
He might have had business.
Is business the reason he came back here and didn't celebrate the New Year with you in Paris? It's probably a lot more romantic than Malibu. She looked up at him, all manner of friendliness struck clean from her.
You ask a great many questions, Mr. Archer.
I know. It goes with the job, and I like to do my job well.
I think I will be leaving now.
I thought you might.
I need to powder my nose.
I'll watch your bag. When she got back, there was no fresh powder on her nose. That had just been an excuse, and the woman was sloppy with details, it seemed. He wondered who Bonham had called while she'd been gone. He carried her suitcase and walked her to the cab stand. He left her there after giving her his card and asking her to tell her husband to leave a message at that number.
I will tell him about our conversation as soon as I see him,
she promised. I'm sure you will, thought Archer. By the time she got into her cab, he was in the Delahaye and took up the chase. The taxi did not go to Malibu. It went instead to Chinatown. And more specifically, to the Jade Lion, which didn't surprise Archer one little bit. When Chinatown got involved in things, it tended to stay involved. Chapter 34 Bonham paid off the cab and walked up the steps to the front door. Archer eased to the curb a little down the street. It was too early for the Jade to be officially open for business, he knew. The doorman he'd fought before was nowhere in sight. If Archer was really lucky, he might be in a hospital. But another man was there. Archer saw him as he came out to greet Bonham. It was the gray-suited gent with the scars, though he was now attired in a dark blue pinstripe with a pale blue pocket square. Now he knew who Bonham had called from the airport. Archer popped open his glove box, snagged his Kodak camera, took aim, and fired off a few photos. The pair spoke for about a minute and then went inside. Even with his window down, Archer couldn't hear a word of their conversation from this distance, but he knew that he and his questions were probably the number one topic. He drove off and headed to Green and Ransom. It was time he reported in with his client. Along the way, he dropped off the film for development and paid for a fast turnaround. When he walked into the office, he was met by Audrey, the receptionist. She was in her 50s, with a pencil stuck in her hair bun. Archer wanted to snatch it out, as though it were King Arthur's sword in the stone, and freeing it would grant him all the answers he needed. But it was just a pencil stuck in hair, and the answers would have to come the hard way.
While Miss Ransom is at Warner's filming today, she said if you came by to tell you that she put your name on the visitor sheet at the gate, Mr. Archer.
Thanks. I'll head over there now. I understand Bart Green is in Vegas. Efficient now looked suspicious.
I have no idea where he is.
His wife told me that's where he was. Now Audrey just blinked at him. Have the cops been by to ask questions about Eleanor Lamb? She shook her head but said nothing. I hear Green flies up to Vegas on his own plane with his own pilot. Must be nice. That got him four blinks in staccato. Does he go to Vegas a lot? He likes to gamble, I take it. That got him five blinks, and then Audrey picked up the phone before saying,
Will there be anything else?
No. But can I compliment you on your answers? They're some of the best I've ever heard. Matt got him a smile with no words or blinks tacked on. He headed north to Warner Brothers, which was located in the southeastern tip of the San Fernando Valley in Burbank. The skies were still sunny, but with a chance of severe thunderstorms once he got there, depending on how things went with his client. Archer passed through the suburbs of Burbank, where the paltry-built middle-income neighborhoods looked like they'd been stamped out by tool-and-die concerns with the goal of a dull sameness that not even the Soviets could approach. But maybe that was okay. A house was to live in, not live your life through like maybe those moneyed folks did in Bel Air and Beverly Hills. He found a parking spot down the street from the studio, which was a miracle unto itself. The guard at the gate found his name on the list and directed him to one of the sound stages. He waited until the red light went off, and then rang the bell on the door. He gave his name to the woman who answered and asked to see Ransom when she had a moment. 10 minutes passed, and Ransom opened the door and stepped out.
Follow me, Archer,
she said in a tone that made Archer think the woman was still in director mode. She strode off, and he had to step quickly to keep up. Ransom was dressed in a man's suit, but tailored for her shape. Instead of a tie, she had a colorful scarf around her neck. Her hair danced over her shoulders and was capped by a lavender beret. She would have looked très chic on the streets of Paris, he thought. She led him to a series of small Spanish-style bungalows and unlocked the door of one. They stepped inside, where Archer found a comfortable office space and casual seating, with a full bar set up against one wall. Movie posters from old Warner Brothers flicks were in frames on every wall. She poured herself a club soda and lemon and asked him what he wanted. "Same but the lime over the lemon. I'm working," he added, smiling. They sat across from each other in leather club chairs. "Nice place," he said. "Yours?"
"So long as you make the money, the studios give you almost whatever you want."
Archer wondered what all that might encompass. "What's the picture you're directing?"
"Let's just call it Moby Dick, only from the whale's perspective."
"Should be a big hit." She made a show of looking at her watch.
"What have you found out?"
"You like boleros?" He had asked the question to see if Sam Malloy had filled his grandniece in on their conversation. By the look on her face, the old cop had decided to let Archer play it out for himself.
"I like it fine. Why do you ask?"
He explained what had happened after she'd left boleros. "Sam Malloy is a swell guy. He's very proud of you."
"And I think the world of him."
"He filled me in. He went to get his advice. It was a good move."
"And he said I was in good hands with you."
She glanced down at his bandaged hand.
"What happened?"
"I just ran into a knife a guy was holding over in Chinatown." She sat back in her chair, crossing one leg over the other in the most unfeminine manner Archer had ever seen a woman manage. He was actually quite impressed.
"Why Chinatown?"
He decided to pull out the same matchbook he had shown Alice Jacoby.
"The Jade Lion?"
Ransom said, reading the name off the cover. "I found a bunch of them in Lamb's desk."
"And what did you find there, besides the man with the knife?"
"I found a shot of pure fire in a glass, and then I went snooping."
"And did you find anything connecting Ellie to this place?"
"Nothing directly, but I found out lots of other things."
"Like what?"
"I'll keep them to myself for now. It might be safer for you if I do."
"That bad, huh?"
"People will go to disgusting lengths to make a buck. Let's leave it at that. You know a gal named Alice Jacoby?"
"I do, slightly. She works at Warner's as a set designer. Good reputation."
"Your tastes aren't simpatico, at least," she said.
"Aren't we getting rather far afield? Have you made any progress?"
"Have the county cops been by to talk to you?"
"No, they haven't."
Archer sat back, puzzled. "Okay. Have they questioned anyone else at the company?"
"Not that anyone has told me."
"All right. Do you know Peter and/or Bernadette Bonham?"
"No. Who are they?"
"Next door neighbors of Lamb's. I met Mrs. Bonham at the airport today. She was in France, and now she's not. Same for her hubby." Ransom lazily rubbed her cheek, but her look was focused.
"Why is that important?"
"I told her about Lamb being missing and the dead body. She seemed surprised. I say it seemed, because I'm not sure. After she left the airport, guess where she went?"
"I don't like games, Mr. Archer."
"The Jade Lion. And she met up with a guy that works there and..." On this, Archer stopped, because he had caught sight of a man on a movie poster who looked familiar. He was staring so hard that Ransom finally turned to look.
"What?"
"That poster. The craggy guy with the scars on his face."
"That's Raymond Massey. That's the movie poster for Arsenic and Old Lace with Cary Grant. Why?"
"It just reminded me of the guy Bonham met today." She turned to face him with a pair of peaked eyebrows.
"I seriously doubt that Raymond Massey works at a bar in Chinatown."
Archer had a thought. What was Massey's character name in that movie? She thought for a moment.
"Mortimer? No, that was Cary Grant's character. Jonathan. Jonathan Brewster was Massey's character."
"Yeah, I thought you might say that."
"What does that have to do with anything?"
"What was Massey's role in the film?"
"A maniacal killer on the run from the cops, even though the movie was a screwball comedy, of sorts. Grant was really ham-handed in it, overacting and such, which he freely admits. but it made a lot of money. The movie was based on a Broadway play of the same title. In the play, Boris Karloff was Jonathan Brewster, and Massey patterned his character and his face after Karloff.
And the scars?
The doctor he traveled with, Peter Lorre, played him in the movie, had performed surgery on Massey's character to change his appearance. Lorre's character was a drunk. The result was a monstrous face full of scars.
My, my. How art imitates life.
What's the name of the scarred man who met this Bonham woman?
I'm going to have to find that out. But the thing is, Lamb had the name Jonathan Brewster in her will at her house in Malibu, with the Jade Lion written under it. Ransom immediately saw his point.
So Jonathan Brewster was her code name for this scarred gentleman at the Jade. That way, if anyone saw her Wheeldex...
they wouldn't know who she was referring to, unless they were well up on their movies. And from what I've seen, you're being kind calling him a gentleman.
So you really think Ellie's been to this place?
Oh, I think so. And I think she knows Scarface, too, at least in some way. And if her neighbors, the Bonhams, know him as well?
Do you believe this could be connected to her disappearance?
Right now, I wouldn't bet against it. I just have to figure out how it's connected. He took a swallow of his club soda and lime. I met Mallory Green earlier today. She said Bart is in Vegas, on business. She shrugged.
I don't know. He doesn't really communicate his schedule or plans.
Does he like to gamble?
What makes you ask that?
She said. Why else does anyone go to Vegas?
I don't know if he gambles or not. Our relationship is pretty much restricted to filmmaking.
He has his own plane and pilot? Said Archer.
Yes.
Have you ever been up in it?
No, I'm not keen on flying, actually. Well, Archer, I can't say I'm overwhelmed with what you've found so far.
I'm not overwhelmed by it either. But try this one on. Lamb paid nearly $73,000 for her place in Malibu, including the renovations.
That's a lot of money.
And she didn't take out a mortgage. She paid for it all in cash. Any idea where it might have come from? Asked Archer. Ransom looked genuinely surprised.
No. We pay well, but not that well.
If you did, I was going to try to get a job at Green and Ransom. Thanks for the time and non-alcoholic drink. I could almost get used to them. Almost. He rose. She didn't.
What's your next move?
She asked. As soon as I figure it out, you'll be the second to know. Chapter 35. Archer picked up his developed prints and the negatives and made a phone call from a payphone in a Rexall drugstore. The man he was calling was named Jake Nichols, and what the man didn't know about Chinatown would barely fill a Baijiu tumbler. He was a former PI turned barkeep. 5 years ago, he'd been shot by police. Accidentally, they'd said, while he was looking into a mob-backed gambling ring operating out of Chinatown. Turned out the coppers who pulled the trigger, and their immediate superiors, were actually all in with the mob boys. And when this was conclusively shown, Nichols had gotten a large payout from the city.